Shrink Wrap Radio number 501, Mindfulness and Relationship Enmeshment, with psychoanalyst Ann Chandler.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is New York-based psychoanalyst Ann Chandler, PhD, who teaches and writes on the integration of spirituality and psychoanalysis. She brings an Eastern sensibility to the Western practice of psychoanalytic psychotherapy. We'll be discussing when mindfulness meets enmeshment, disentangling without detaching. Before we get started, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is The Psychotherapist's Guide to the Brain, Part 2, focusing on the limbic system. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today, and I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ann Chandler, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show, and I believe you're also a listener to the show. Do I have that right?
You are correct.
Yay! Yes. I always love it when I have professionals out there who find this a worthwhile endeavor. When I first thought about podcasting, it never occurred to me that that would happen.
Well, I have to admit that I heard about you through a patient. So it has trickled down and back up.
Yeah, and that's happened before. I've heard that before, so that's also very pleasing. Now, I'm pretty sure that you're the first psychoanalyst that I've ever interviewed who also captured a world championship in Ultimate Frisbee. It's just not the image that first comes to mind in response to the word psychoanalyst.
No, definitely not. But it certainly explains sort of where I got to where I am today professionally, which is integrating more of the body. Because I've been an athlete my whole life. In fact, I just ran the New York City Half Marathon on Sunday.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you. But yeah, I played Ultimate through, well, I started, I actually first played Ultimate Frisbee in Paris when I was a study abroad student my junior year. And when I returned to college at Duke University, I played for real with a research triangle team and then came back to New York and played club and wound up competing in a world championship with a team out of California.
Wow. Well, and, just briefly, what is Ultimate Frisbee? What's ultimate about it?
Ultimate is... ultimate is a sport is played on a football-size field with two end zones, as you have in football, and it's a team sport with seven members each on a team, and the goal is to throw a frisbee to a receiver, much like in football, into the end zone, and you score a point.
Sounds like fun.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's a non-refereed game. It is governed by what's called the spirit of the game. And so all disputes are resolved. They are resolved, but they're resolved between opponents of the two teams. And only at the higher level, and now there's actually professional level Ultimate Frisbee for men, there are referees at that level. But in my time and in my experience, it was only... self-refereed, but it's played worldwide and it has grown. Now there are middle school, high school, certainly collegiate and post-collegiate, which is what I mostly played, which is club, and now professional. And wait, I can't stop there because I just found out that we as the ultimate organization is vying for an Olympic status sport.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you on the Olympics before too long. So how does an athlete such as yourself transition into psychology? What got you interested in psychology?
Well, I guess after college, a sibling was experiencing an interpersonal crisis and was having a very hard time and sort of came to me for help, but really should have gone for some professional help. And I wound up myself becoming depressed and because of something that had happened to someone very dear and very loved by me. And I wound up seeking therapy for the first time. And so I wound up in a therapist's office and found that process extremely fascinating and extraordinarily helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right after college, and that was led me to take led me to think about a career of my own as a psychologist. And I, you know, took a couple of classes, and then one thing led to the other, and I went for my doctorate and a couple of postdocs, and voila.
Yeah. Now, from psychologist to psychoanalyst, how did that happen? What was it that called you to move on to that?
Well, I'm a person who is just innately curious, and I like getting sort of to the bottom of things, and I like a lot of depth. I privilege and really appreciate depth, and so I think in part so I had a brief course of therapy, as I described, you know, in my early 20s, and then when I started graduate school, about 5 years later, I wanted to get back into therapy and wound up getting the name of someone who herself was a psychoanalyst and trained at a particular institute. So I really liked how she worked, and it was on a deeper level than I had experienced previously. And I found my way to the institute and started, you know, going to open houses. And it was a combination of the people that sort of embodied the analytic spirit and some of the thinking of the analytic, you know.
So now in the latest chapter of your adventure, you're headed to Rome. And you're going to be a presenter for the second international conference on mindfulness. What's the subject that you're going to be presenting on?
The subject of my oral presentation is going to be when mindfulness meets enmeshment. It is about how we can use the body, getting grounded in the body, to address a certain kind of relationship dynamic in which boundaries are porous and the distinction between the two people is a bit blurry. So it's considered an applied paper about applied mindfulness.
Okay.
and with some psychoanalytic sort of concepts along the way.
Yeah, I've not heard of those two you know, being together before, enmeshment, mindfulness, and you might not have been expecting this, but I'm wondering if some kind of a case or example comes to mind where you could kind of give us, say a little bit more about what an enmeshed relationship might look like. Can you modify maybe somebody you've seen in therapy or something to kind of give us an idea?
Sure, absolutely. It's a great question. Yes, for example, a woman in her 30s or early 30s who has a mother who is very unstable and volatile, very emotionally unregulated, and who always leaned on her daughter to sort of be there for her, to sort of be pulled into her own emotional sagas. And so in my practice, I have this woman now, she's in her early 30s, and she spends hours on the phone with the mother, who lives on the other side of the country, and more time than she even cares to give to this parent, and winds up hanging up the phone and is in a funk for hours, and wants to be left alone, doesn't want to interact with her husband, and spends an awful lot of time in her own therapy complaining and talking about the mother's woes. And so
she's more focused on the mother than on her own difficulties.
Exactly, and unaware of the ways in which her life has been sidelined, her needs, her desires, mm-hmm. her goals in life, mm-hmm. Aspirations, confidence, have been compromised because the mother has always come first. The mother's needs have always been primary, and so our work is to try to. And my work with anybody in that predicament is to try to sort of reclaim their core self.
Yeah. I wonder, and I know you probably weren't expecting this question either. I don't know if you're a movie person. I'm a big movie person. And this has the feeling of a number of movies, and I can't think of one. But I wonder if there's one that comes to mind for you.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I bet there are a question. I wasn't.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. It may magically bubble up from your unconscious at some point in our conversation.
Yeah, okay? It probably will.
Yeah, and maybe it'll bubble up in mine. I think there is one of the last Woody Allen movies that might fit, and I can't remember the name of it. One of his most recent ones.
Blue Jasmine?
Yes, Blue Jasmine.
Oh,
is there an element of that in
more.
There?
I can't recall some of the details.
Me either. Let's move on. So how do people end up in these enmeshed relationships?
Well, sort of unbeknownst to them, it usually originates in childhood, not unlike the story I just told, but where there's a parent who is has oftentimes an unresolved trauma or loss or unmet need, dependency needs, and winds up unwittingly turning to a child for the things that they didn't get. Probably from their own parents in their own upbringings. And so they transfer it onto someone whose job it should never be,
right,
to take care of, parent. And it starts early on. It starts, when I think that there's unresolved, psychological issues in the parent.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering what led you to, what's drawn you to this topic, and of course that makes me wonder if in fact you have personal experience, if you yourself or somebody in your family struggled with this.
Hope yeah.
It's not too personal.
Not at all. I mean, I think we're all writing about something that's very personal,
yeah.
No matter what we're writing, even if it's fiction, I think there's something of us in all of it. For me personally, I had a mother who struggled with depression and who also was that person who had a lot of unmet dependency needs from her childhood. And, you know, she also had my mother had a strained marriage. And so being the only girl in the family, also just being sensitive temperamentally, just sort of my disposition, was in fact a lethal combination because, you know, I wound up really internalizing and identifying a lot of the pain that my mother was in. Both what I knew and could see visibly she was in and what was sort of in the air, you know, in our family. And so it does come, you know, this is how I came to this.
Okay.
Through the experience of having grown up in an enmeshed relationship, which didn't occur to me. I wasn't aware of it. I was aware of the ways in which I was burdened by her struggles, but I wasn't aware of how enmeshed I was until much more recently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're combining that topic with mindfulness, so I'm guessing that maybe mindfulness was an important tool for you in dealing with enmeshment.
Very much so. Another personal, I guess the impetus for my writing occurred was owing to an event from about 6 years ago, and at that time, my oldest daughter's friend, who was 14, was killed in a tragic, you know, horrific car accident. And so my oldest child had experienced a devastating loss, and I'm getting to the answer to your question about how mindfulness sort of works into all this.
I'm not worried.
Okay. So, you know, I had an appropriate and sort of understandable and expectable response as a parent to a child who's in pain, and did all the sort of practical, useful things, you know, help drive her places to be with her camp friends because it was a summer camp friend who had been killed. And then as time went on, I found myself almost too preoccupied with her experience. Mm-hmm. And to the point where I had coffee with a friend of mine probably about 4 to 6 months after the loss. And when my friend didn't ask me about how I was doing or even my daughter was doing with regard to that, I left my coffee date, and I felt I was bothered. And at that moment, I realized, like, something's got me here. Something is I'm more taken by my daughter's experience as though it was my friend that was killed when it wasn't, you know. So, and I had also found myself my fuse was a little shorter than usual, and I was just more anxious, preoccupied. And I thought, wow, now's the time to take that mindfulness class that a friend of mine, who's a holistic practitioner, had recommended probably 2 years ago. I said, you know what, like, for the sake of my children, my family, like, I need to just get a grip. And so I need to try something new. So I found my way to one of the Jon Kabat-Zinn mindfulness-based stress reduction courses, it changed my life. And it was because of that, I think, you know, much has been written about how mindfulness supports the creative process. Through the meditation practice, I found myself just thinking creatively about a bunch of different things, and I wound up thinking about my reaction to my daughter's loss, and and my hyper empathy, if you will, mm-hmm. As a result of the mindfulness it somehow it just gave me more internal space to sort of sort these things out.
Yeah. Not sure that. Yeah, thanks for sharing that with us. And it brought to mind somebody in my family. I don't want to give away too many details here, but a woman in my family who gets together with her best friend, but not as often as they might because this other woman talks about her daughters. That's all she talks about. And everything that they experience, anything that they do, it comes back to her daughters. And so there's a way in which there's no real relationship there.
Right. It's like there's not a the person who's preoccupied with their daughter is not sort of their own person. Yeah. I mean, they're not. Yeah.
Yeah. Like. And this is a person who also is very invested in doing for others generally. You know, so it's definitely not putting herself first.
Right. Well, you're sort of anticipating where my thinking goes with this, and that is that in enmeshment, for the person, so it starts out being the child who's sort of caught up in the enmeshment, sort of victimized by it as a youngster. They didn't have a choice. They were helpless. They wind up putting the other person's needs and experience before their own. And so it's like other first, then self. And when I think it really, you know, what it needs to be the other way around, where it's self, then other. And I always like to use the example that they, you know, of the message they give you on, or the instructions they give you on an airplane, that any adults traveling with children should put their oxygen masks on first before assisting any young ones. So, mm-hmm. You know, like, so that the self really, as an adult, really needs to become before the concern for other. Now, I don't mean to come across sounding like we all need to be more selfish,
right,
but there's
right.
a healthy kind of self-care that the person who has been enmeshed really needs to attend to.
Yes.
And prioritize.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So I'm wondering how specifically mindfulness helps one generally, to become unenmeshed.
So the mindfulness, by definition, you know, if I can paraphrase, is a paying attention to moment-to-moment experience, thoughts, feelings, impulses, without judgment. And the means by which we practice mindfulness meditation is through something called one-mindedness, which is just sort of bringing your attention to one a focal point. And in most cases, it's the breath.
Yes.
And so the work of the mindfulness is to still the mind, not stop what comes up, but just sort of coexist with it, you know, peacefully, whether they're feelings, thoughts, whatever it might be. And to root oneself in the moment and to get away from what one of your earlier guests talks about, David Wan.
Yes.
To get away from the representational world, you know, our world, our cerebral, intellectual world, and to come back into the body, because the body is, and he said this, I believe that the body is the substrate of emotion. So what we feel in our heads, what we think, is really what we feel. You know, our thoughts are chemicals, right? I mean, so everything has a physical basis. So the mindfulness helps us root ourselves in the present, but in our core true self. It gets us back to what is real in the here and now. And that is the beginning of forging a relationship with one's self in a way that maybe the person has never experienced if they've been enmeshed, because the relationship has always been centered around the other, you know, another person.
Yeah.
So the mindfulness gets you really sort of like lands you in yourself. And then you can begin to have a relationship with yourself in a way that may never have been modeled for you. I think of it as like holding like a baby chicken. Like you're holding your own experience when you're meditating and when you're being mindful, when you're with your experience. You're holding it like you would a baby chicken, just with tenderness, with softness, with kindness, with love.
That's such a great metaphor. I actually experienced that in my body as you talk about it. You know, I've got my little chick right here.
Yeah, it's so. I have to thank my Pilates teacher for that one. Uh-huh. You know, I think when we had to angle our chins down, she's like, you know, not too much. Just pretend there's a soft, you know, baby chicken there. Oh. So it was just, yeah. So yeah, I like that metaphor too, because that is a way to sort of it's a metaphor for our own experience of holding our own experience in a way that we've never that's never happened, and so we've got to sort of I don't want to say reparenting, but we can, through the mindfulness meditation, we become the benevolent parent who's paying attention to our experience.
Paying attention, but non-judgmentally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So just to be, it's a being with of the best kind, of the healthiest kind, the way, you know, a mother holds a baby and just is there.
Okay.
And so it's like we become both the parent and the child in this process.
Okay. I've never heard it spoken of in quite these terms. And it brings to mind a couple of questions. One is, how does this practice help you in the psychoanalytic work that you do? I'm wondering if you do mindfulness meditation just before seeing someone or just after. Tell us about that.
Sure. I have a pretty rigorous practice most days. On the weekends sometimes I don't sit, but I try to sit before the workday begins. You know, again, if I can't, I'm not going to give myself a hard time about it. I also participate, I'm part of a sangha, which is a community of like-minded psychoanalysts, and we meet, in fact, it's going on, I gave it up for this for today, but I did my meditating this morning, and we meet once a week in Manhattan, and it is...
How many in your group?
There's the facilitator, and then five of us. So it's a total of six.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. I mean, I think every shrink, psychoanalyst or otherwise, would really benefit from, you know, 5 to 10 minutes a day of just being still.
Yeah.
Physically still. I mean, the mind's going to wander and then you just bring it back to the breath. But just there's a cleansing quality to that exercise.
And what comes from the sangha? What comes from being with these fellow professionals? Does that bring something more to the experience?
You mean when I come back to my office or just to the experience with those people?
Well, both. But those are both good questions.
Well, what it certainly supports is contemplation, is a stance that differs from this sort of traditional psychoanalytic one, where the focus of attention is largely on ideation, on concepts, constructs, on it just privileges the intellect.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because, as a little aside, Freud said that there is a body ego before there's a psychic one. I mean, our experience in and of the world begins in a sensory motor way. We're touching, we're mouthing, like it.
Right.
Before there's language, there's felt experience, there's the physical realm, and there's being held. And so, sadly, in psychoanalysis, the body is sort of a forgotten entity. So what the sangha does is it really helps, it makes me more relaxed, so that when I'm in my office listening to my patients and I listen, my attention is just, I'm not as gripped, I'm more open, not always. I mean, there are times when I'm reacting and I'm, doing the human thing. But it helps me to attend not just to the words, but to the music, to the feeling, and I might listen to how because of the meditation and because it helps quiet my mind, I can focus in on the individual's relationship to him or herself, like are they holding their experience like a baby chicken or not,
Part of the question I had, or assumption that I have, is that being with your fellow professionals in this group meditating, is that there's something extra that happens that in a way, the group is holding you like a baby chicken.
Yeah,
that you're all totally. Giving that you're all giving
there
that to one another.
Completely. I was just reading. The group leader just sent something. I didn't read the whole thing, but he sent something out to us last night from Thich Nhat Hanh about the power of the sangha. And yes, there is, and I think this was in that email, that there has to be generosity of spirit, love, kindness, trust, mm-hmm. a sense of safety, all of those things. And those are things that you would hope to have with your own therapist. But there's something about the sitting without and listening without judgment that I get in that sangha, which I do not find when I go to the Analytic Institute where I trained, where I got a tremendous amount and I still give back to. But, when there are group events, there's sort of like a one-upping and a competition, right. and a judging, yeah. and there's that sort of stuff in the air that is not present in this sangha, where exactly, that's so well put, where I feel so held by the experience.
Now, in your work as a psychoanalyst, do you bring it explicitly into the session at all? Do you coach your patients to become meditators or to practice mindfulness?
I think it's a bit of self-selection. I mean, people know that I integrate spirituality into my work, and so I think they seek me out, or I get referrals in part for that reason. And so some of them already come with a spiritual practice. It could mm-hmm. be anything from yoga to mindfulness. I infrequently will do a formal meditation, but I do it. I mean, I have like a great meditation, a guided meditation that I borrow from and use from time to time, or I might just sit quietly. I have one woman who sometimes likes to just start the session with 5 minutes of silence, of just sitting quietly, you know, coming from her work day. Did some mindfulness meditation with someone this morning for a couple of minutes. But mostly it's just sort of, it's in me and it comes across. And again, it has to do with what I'm attending to, where my attention goes. And if I hear someone being very judgmental of themselves, the mindfulness is what's picking up on that. And many of my patients do practice mindfulness, whether it's they use the Headspace app or...
I've used that myself.
And that's a great one. And I've referred people to a more formal MBSR course. I've had a couple of people do that, but it's not a prerequisite or a requirement for being in treatment with me.
Both psychoanalysis, psychotherapy generally, and psychoanalysis, I think specifically, has a fair amount of overlap with the kind of awareness that you hope that the client will develop in the process of the therapy, that they will be aware. Do you use a couch at all, the psychoanalytic couch?
Only to sit on. People don't lie on it.
Okay. So, because I think the whole couch thing is very interesting, and I know a lot of people kind of poo-pooed it for a long time, but I think that it can help to induce a kind of altered state of consciousness. So my question is, what I think there's a lot of overlap. Would you agree? And if you do, what's distinctive about, what's the difference between mindfulness meditation and psychotherapy self-awareness?
Well, I think what the mindfulness meditation brings to the fore for me is an attention to compassion and loving kindness. So while psychoanalysts are trained to have evenly hovering attention, you know, mm-hmm. between the id, the ego, the superego, or there's another analyst, another analytic forefather who talks about coming into each session without memory or desire, so you're sort of just there, you're just showing up.
Yeah, that sounds very very Buddhist in a way.
Very Buddhist, yeah. Very Zen. Yeah. And he was more so into loving kindness than Freud. I think there are a lot of similarities, but the difference is I think for the Buddhist or the spiritual analytic practitioner, emptiness, the concept of emptiness, is a positive thing. And I think from the analytic framework, it might be seen in a more pathologized way. So it's sort of how you're thinking. You know, there is definitely a lot of overlap, but the psycho analyst, I don't think, is paying as much attention to the person's relationship to themselves, and might get more caught up in their relationship with others.
And what about for the client? What's the difference in awareness for the client who maybe has not been a mindfulness meditator?
I think that person might be more caught up in their representational world and in might be more caught up and stuck in suffering. I think mindfulness helps give us perspective on our experience. And when we are suffering, we come to know it. Versus in psychoanalysis, you can really get stuck in sort of an obsessional rabbit hole, and you know, where you're looking for theoretical or intellectual understanding, but missing the bigger picture of the suffering that one is stuck in, okay. If that makes sense.
Yeah, you had sent me some ideas that we could discuss here, and that sort of evokes one of the things that you spoke about when you wrote me, which is the concept of leaning into the pain. And tell us about that and why that's important to our psychological well-being.
Well, I think none of us likes to feel pain. And when we, and as a result, and when we don't, I think we get stuck in suffering. The guided meditation, which is, it's not called leaning into pain. I think it's giving into, I forget what it's called, but anyway, they use the metaphor of a fist, and it's like the outside is the suffering, but what's on the inside is the pain, and that it's important to touch the pain in order to touch one's true core self. And so it's like holding the chicken again, the baby chicken. It's like, you know, holding that part of yourself that for the enmeshed individual or, you know, who was once an enmeshed child or not, but that holding the experience is to hold one's pain with, you know, a gentleness. And if we don't touch the heart of the matter, then I think we can just sort of perpetuate our suffering. So, you know, the person who is stuck in the enmeshed relationship is really suffering and experiencing pain in a way that they may not even be aware of. And in order to dig themselves out, I think they need to feel the pain of sort of the years and the time lost and spent, you know, absorbed in someone else's experience more so than their own.
You know, the sort of the common wisdom is that you can't change another person, you have to work on yourself, and that, and from a family systems point of view too, that when one person changes, it changes the structure of the organization. So I'm wondering, as a person who is the enmeshed person, well, I guess actually there are two enmeshed people. So I was going to try to the person who's the patient who is enmeshed, suffering from enmeshment, as they become clearer, less enmeshed, does that have any impact on that system, on that dyadic system of enmeshment?
Absolutely. It's sort of like just physics, right? It's like, yeah, if one object changes its position, all the rest are forced to find a new relationship to it. And but when it comes to people, you know, I guess I would just modify that and say if the enmeshed person changes her stance, then it's an invitation to others to find a new way of relating mm-hmm. to that individual. And most of the time, I've seen, you know, I mean, I'm a small little dust speck in the world of psychoanalysis over the, you know, time. But in my experience, I've never known a relationship to break off, to end mm-hmm. as a result of somebody getting healthier and emerging from enmeshment. The relationship does change, but it doesn't go away.
Yeah. You know, going back to the leaning into pain, is it the case that to get better, people have to go through pain, that you have to go through darkness and pain and struggle and so on? Does anybody have an easy path in therapy?
Well, yes and no. I think in a warm, loving, supportive, therapeutic dyad relationship, that I think that's the part that makes it easy.
Makes it tolerable.
It's exactly. It's there's a comforting, contributing, you know, role that plays. So that's not easy at all. But this reminds me of yesterday. I was supervising someone, an analytic candidate, and her patient seems to be feeling depressed or more depressed. And the student, my supervisee, was starting to worry, and I said, it's too soon to worry. And more than that, this is an opportunity. If this person is starting to feel stuff she's never felt before, mm-hmm. and she's more reflective and, you know, hold on and enjoy the ride. Now, easier just for me to say that, for her to feel that. I mean, not that she's enjoying the fact that her patient is having a hard time, but there is, like Joni Mitchell said, in every depression, there's a pearl, a pearl of wisdom. I think I probably butchered that.
I didn't know she said that. Was that in one of her songs?
No, I think it was. No, I think I read that somewhere.
Okay.
Is it possible I read it in Patti Smith's book? But I feel like I read it somewhere. But okay. It's so true. That we have to feel, it's in feeling the pain that we discover and can hold the baby chicken.
Okay.
Like, it's like, oh, the baby chicken's in pain.
Yeah.
And we get to hold it like we're holding our own heart, you know, heart, baby chicken, that we're holding it and comforting it and being with our pain. It's not just feeling it, it's finding a way to be with it.
How do we be with another person, maybe with a friend outside of the therapy situation? How do we be with another person who is in pain without getting caught up in their pain? I answered the question in the way I posed it. But.
No, I mean, I think we're all, you know, I had a supervisor who once said, we're all a little bit of everything, you know, schizoid, obsessive compulsive, narcissistic, you know, the list goes on. And I think we're all a little
raising my hand.
So I think, so too are we all a little bit enmeshed. So I don't want to pathologize. I mean, you know, I think it's the mindfulness, it's the awareness of our experience that lets us know whether we've sort of gone too far. Like if we're churning over someone else's problem and we're trying to figure out all sorts of ways to help them, and we find that we're spending, you know, more hours of the day preoccupied with that, you might ask yourself, you know, am I too caught up? Like, am I fearing whether this person, you know, can't sort of survive their own experience. You know, when you're working too hard to try to find solutions rather than just finding a way to be with someone else's pain. I mean, so many of us are so prefer the human doing thing rather than the human being, which is just to be with someone else's pain, the way I'm suggesting that we need to work on being with our own and doing less. So I think I don't recall if you're asking, you know, how do we know if we're enmeshed or how do we be with someone else's pain? I think you did just answer it. We just sort of sit with it and breathe through it and reflect it back, like that it sounds really painful.
Okay, well, I wonder if there's anything more that you'd like to say, maybe something that you were hoping to squeeze in here that you didn't get a chance to.
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, psychoanalysis is necessary but not sufficient. And I think that the mindfulness for me, and I like to think for my patients and for my family, certainly, my kids were the first to tell me several years ago, like, wow, Mom, you're so different, that it has enhanced, you know, the quality, it enhances the quality of our lives and gives us a new kind of awareness and sensitivity to our experience that's different than, you know, than the just the pure conceptual one. We need to know our stories. I think we need to have a personal narrative, and then we need to look at our relationship to it to make sure that we're not stuck in suffering.
Well, that is a great wrap-up statement. So, Dr. Ann Chandler, I want to thank you for being my guest this morning on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Ann Chandler. I've heard mindfulness touted as a remedy for many conditions. So many and so often, in fact, that you've heard me speculate if we might be in a mindfulness bubble. But I had never heard it as a way to deal with enmeshment or what might also be referred to as codependence. Maybe mindfulness is not so much a faddish bubble as it is a genuine cultural shift. Only time will tell. In that regard, though, I was particularly impressed to hear that Dr. Chandler is part of a meditation community, or sangha, with other psychoanalysts. I used to think of psychoanalysts and psychoanalysis as ultra-stiff and conservative. Clearly, they have been evolving along with the rest of the world. In part, I think it's to some degree age-related. I'm reminded of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which I seem to recall that he suggests that the dinosaurs need to die off for a new paradigm to be born. However, some of us dinosaurs are doing our level best to keep up and to evolve.
Hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Clive Van Hilton, and I started listening to Shrink Wrap Radio just a couple of weeks ago. Listened to about 6 episodes now. I'm not a practitioner as such, just somebody who, you know, likes to work on his head kind of thing. and self-development, my spiritual self-development is something that's important to me and becoming more important to me. And I just want to thank you for the great resource that is your podcast and the therapist that one can listen to by means of it. And I just want to, again, give you my thanks and to say that I've set up a recurring monthly PayPal donation to help support the show. Thanks so much for doing this and bringing it your knowledge and the knowledge of all of your guests to a much wider audience and all of us on the internet, basically. Okay, thanks very much indeed, and please carry on the great work. Thank you.
Clive, I do hope to carry on this work thanks to you and to other donors out there and those to come, who I hope will be inspired by your example. And I'm happy to announce that we do have new donors since the last episode. My sincere appreciation goes out to Clive Van Hilton, who we just heard from, Carrie Dine, or Dean, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Patricia Brannigan, and Noor Beckwith.
I'm happy to announce that we do have a new transcript as well on the site, and it's number 493, My Shamanic Healing Journey with Nathan Ehrlich. And that transcript is thanks to Gloria Ullman, who I'm sure will be very appreciated, not only for all of her past transcripts, but this one in particular received some very good interest from listeners out there. So I think they'll be happy to have the transcript. Let me remind you that you can use the Amazon.com search widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase more than just books. It's not for nothing that Amazon's been called the everything store. If you'll remember to go to our site and use that widget for all your Amazon purchases, it will really help us. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly, as we do in our family, to purchase all sorts of things. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrinkwrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. And it's another way that you can help to support us. And in the left-hand sidebar, we've got some ads, Amazon ads. For example, you can click on special deals from Amazon. One is that you can save up to 90% on textbooks. Another is you can get up to 40% off TurboTax, and this is the time of year for that. And there's a little box that has a different special from Amazon that changes every day. Finally, once again, let me remind you about my CE courses that are offered through the Zur Institute. I have over 100 units there, and you can get them at a 10% discount by using my discount code of DrDave88. That's DrDave88. But wait, there's more. Not only can you get a discount on my courses, but also on any of their other 170 or more courses and private practice materials. Just go to zurinstitute.com, explore their very voluminous site, and use my discount code of DrDave88. And by the way, all their courses and materials are APA approved.
Hi, this is Australian psychologist and author Dr. James Alexander, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, James Alexander, longtime listener, supporter, and past guest. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Noor in Cambridge, Mass., who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a Harvard medical student planning to apply into psychiatry, and I really learn a lot from your podcast and interviews. The content is top-notch and mind-opening, which keeps me growing and thinking broadly while I learn through the biomedical lens for the moment. At the same time, your way of relating to your guests and structuring your show is effective and instructive itself. So thank you very much. Here's what little I can contribute for the time being, but I hope to be able to become a more regular contributor in the future. Best regards," and that's from Noor. Noor, it's great to hear from you, and I really appreciate your financial contribution, especially coming from a student on a limited budget. And next we hear from Oscar in Stockholm, who writes, "What a fine interview with Dr. Revan Suo. Thanks. I was going to raise the question about how spiritual, sexual, and hilarious dreams fit into the model, but you brought it up yourself in your closing talk. I was actually already aware of his theory, although I didn't know the name of its originator, and it's always made a lot of sense to me, but not as an explanation for all kinds of dreams, only for a smaller subset. It's obvious that many dreams I have function as rehearsals for a variety of challenging situations that I may encounter in my daily life, and that can be a great starting point for interpretation. But obviously, there are a lot of mysterious dreams going beyond such a mundane purpose. Dr. Revan Suo's own lucid dream, the best part of the whole interview, speaks to that. Myself, I've seen a substantial increase in mystical, multi-layered, and lucid dreams the last year or so. It's not uncommon for me to have two or even three layered dreams, sometimes four, that is, waking up from a dream in a dream, and so on. I gather that Jung felt that one delves deeper into the unconscious with each descending level, and that the deeper levels somehow reveal deeper truths. I also had a few stunning lucid dreams in which I've talked to eerily realistic people and tried to make reality checks, like looking up stock exchange rates and sports results, but these things are notoriously elusive in a lucid state. For example, my cell phone screen would go blank, and when I asked a guy to borrow his phone to check the internet, he said that the internet is offline on weekends. Those are great examples. Oh, and happy 500. How are you going to celebrate? Does your family recognize your great podcasting accomplishment? Is it something you share with them, like talking about your guests at the dinner table? Or is it a world of your own? I hope you keep on keeping on for a long time to come. And that's from Oscar in Stockholm, who I met when I led a dream weekend there, and we became good friends. Thanks, Oscar. It's always good to hear from you, and you always have such fascinating input, and I'll dodge some of your other questions. Thanks for your congratulations on reaching number 500. And finally, speaking of episode 500 congratulations, let me play a recorded congrats from Mayar in Tehran.
Hi, this is Mahir. I'm a postgraduate psychology student and I live in Tehran, Iran. We've been on the couch from Iran, United States, France, England, Germany, South Africa, Egypt, Finland, and all around the world for 500 episodes. And we're still there in this new spring with Dr. Dave.
Mayar, thanks for your congratulations all the way from Tehran. Even though this is episode number 501, I still appreciate more congratulations like this one. Just send me an audio file. You can use my phone message number, which I'll announce in just a moment, or you can use the app to do it, or do it some other way, and email it to me. And with that, I think we better wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail or congratulations on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Ann Chandler, for sharing her work and insights on mindfulness and enmeshment. My next guest will be Ann Fells, MD, who wrote a very interesting piece for the New York Times on self-medication titled, Can Nicotine Be Good For You? So to learn the answer to that question, we'll see you next time. In the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.